All right, everybody. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Drew McQueenie. I'm from HitFix.com, and it is my distinct pleasure this morning to present Screaming with Laughter, a panel about the new FearNet sitcom, Holliston. We are here today with the co-creators and co-stars of the show. This is, I'll start at the end, Joe Lynch.
Hi. Lovely smattering of applause. Thank you very much.
Next to him, we have Adam Green. And this gentleman is Peter Block, producer of the show and one of the founders of Lionsgate.
I love you, Peter.
So
that was for the podcast.
So I guess the first question, and really the most important question, is, and I'm going to ask this, and then we're going to take a look at a clip from the show. But where did this start for you guys?
I'm the one who sort of created this whole thing, and it started about 13 years ago. I had a job when I got out of college directing the worst local cable commercials that you've ever seen. Like, you know, when you're watching TV late at night and that commercial comes on that starts like halfway through and there's like a website and all these graphics all over it and a guy waving. That was me.
I'm Crazy Max.
Yes. But I was able to steal their equipment at night to make my own stuff. So I made a feature for $400 called Coffee and Donuts that was basically just an autobiography of my life, I guess. So it was about me trying to get over the breakup of my first girlfriend, which even though I'm married, I'm still not quite over. And
it's so awkward.
And the struggle to make it. So that ended up sort of becoming this idea for a TV show, which over the course of the past 13 years, it would almost happen, then it wouldn't, and then finally, when FearNet became like an actual network and Peter became the president, all of a sudden everything just started to click, and finally, after all that time, it started to move. So the show is a sitcom, and we're not making fun of sitcoms or spoofing sitcoms. It's an actual sitcom, just like Friends or Seinfeld, except occasionally people get stabbed in the face.
Head explosions, usually.
And if you'd like to see what that looks like, we've got a clip for you.
Yes. I think this is actually like a sizzle reel.
This gives you a sense of what Holliston is and just how insane it is.
Pardon my technical prowess, I'm a Mac guy.
America. It's a place where two young men can set out to create the one film they know will make them stars.
Mr. Landis, we made a movie.
Okay. It's called Shin Pads.
Shin Pads.
Shin Pads.
That's a terrible title.
He never said action.
Dude, Adam and Joe, they got the lights.
They're making me crazy.
Cut. They got the cameras.
And what we're going for here is total 70s stuff.
But they're not getting.
You should have told me that before I shaved.
Any action.
I don't love you anymore.
Onerous, you're my imaginary friend. You can't just leave me when I'm like this.
Get a hooker.
See, out of you, folks. But they do have lots of friends stopping by. We'll see you next week on The Movie Crypt.
Nice show, dudes.
Thanks, boss.
I gotta get going to band practice. I gotta shave my abs for the ladies in the front row. Hey, Candyman is just a character he plays in movies.
What's Candyman?
Oh, man. That's racist.
This April.
You always say it's not going to hurt, and then I can't poop right for days.
It's funny. When someone loses their head.
Such an idiot.
When life gives you lemon, shove it up your ass.
Holliston, a FearNet original series, premieres April 3rd.
Good evening, Holliston!
All right.
Your moms are going to love it.
My mom does.
So, guys, I got to say that. You say it is a sitcom. I've never seen a sitcom that looks exactly like that. Part of what I liked, because I got to see a chunk of episodes, and part of what I really liked is frequently when we see material that is about film geeks or about guys who are in love with pop culture like this, a lot of the references to me feel like these are the references you're supposed to make. Whereas in this, when you guys are making nods to other films or when you're doing jokes that kind of riff off of our knowledge, You guys not only get it right, but there's a sense that that is the language that you share, that it is very authentic to the fandom that you guys grew up in, and that you then, and that is one of the things that makes you friends. Can you talk about how much of that you brought into this, why you use that as a shared language in the film, and then also just how outrageous you get with it?
Actually, the whole thing with cinema is language. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that everybody in here occasionally likes a good movie or two, you know, maybe quotes Caddyshack every once in a while. It happens. But cinema is language. We use quotes. We use, you know, talking about our favorite movies as a way to communicate with each other. We had done that with a movie that we had done before called Chillerama, where everybody in, like, the drive-in always quotes movies, and it's just something that everybody does. Like, so when we were coming up with the plots, with the ideas, it just felt very natural to, why not have a Scanner's idea, like a joke in there? Why not, you know, and it wasn't planted, it was just, that's what we do. We make references to Poltergeist all the time, or Gremlins, you know. So it's just one of those things that just feels natural to us, and every time that we end up hanging out with friends or whatever, it ends up kind of delving into geekdom anyway. So it was just a natural, like, extension of that.
And as kind of out there as it might look, all of the characters, especially the four main characters, myself, Joe, Corey, and Laura, I wrote all of them based on the actors that are playing them. So we're all sort of playing ourselves just at a lesser time of our lives before we actually did sort of make it or whatever and start actually making careers in this. So everybody...
We're still working on that, actually. So
everybody in this show is sort of in, like, professional purgatory, sort of. It's like they're all doing something to get by, but there's something bigger that they always wanted to do. And that's something that I think everybody can relate to, because I think most people live their whole lives like that. So, yeah, that's really where that all came from. We're just being us. And that's how I wrote every line of dialogue. It was never, how do we hit the horror crowd, how do we hit the Star Wars crowd, which was great that we were allowed the freedom to do that at this network, because most of them wouldn't. And you're right, usually when there's a show like this, they become so fucked with, I guess is the best word, to try to hit all these things that are popular right now. It's like, oh, Pokemon's big, like, make a Pokemon joke. Like, we don't do that. Like, we have jokes about Scanners and American Werewolf and what are some of the most, like, random ones? Oh, the Cannonball Run.
Cannibal Holocaust.
And Cannonball Run. Cannonball Run and Cannibal Holocaust.
Well, Cannibal Holocaust Run.
And it's even deeper. Like, have done this for a while. Like, the Fright Fest films that you guys would put together. There's the ones that I loved where you were riffing off of the Twilight Zone wraparound segments. Yeah. And certainly, you guys, this is something that feels organic to the way you relate with each other on film. How much? Because that so much of the vibe of those Fright Fest shorts is present in the relationship you guys have here as well. Does that just come from how long you've been friends and how long you've worked together, and just how natural that rapport is?
That was when we first met. I'm not going to go all the way back. You don't need that origin story. The book will come out eventually. But when we were going to Fright Fest in England, it's this great film festival in England that shows all horror movies and stuff. Adam had gone the year before with Hatchet, and then he was going the next year with Spiral, and he was nice enough to recommend Wrong Turn 2 for it. So we were going out together, and while we were there, you know, it's a great festival, but they kept showing these shorts, and the shorts were kind of
bad.
Okay, fine, bad. I was trying to have some tact here. There might be a British member in the audience, and they're going to tell them. But so when we left, we were like, we could do that. Why not? So I do a mean Dan Aykroyd. So I thought it was just very natural. And we came back and we'd asked them, you know, would you mind if we did shorts for, you know, each night of the festival? So we picked Twilight Zone the movie, the opening with Dan Aykroyd and Albert Brooks, and we basically recreated that for each night. And each night I would do, well, something really scary, and then turn around and then it would be something different. I would turn into Daniel Harris, which has always been a fantasy of mine.
But I got to kiss her.
Which is technically, if you watch it, he's kissing me. So the homoeroticism has already...
You just ruined the whole thing.
Sorry. But when we did those, it was just so much fun. And it was just kind of like us hanging out. Just there happened to be cameras around. So we did it again where we put ourselves in American Werewolf in London. And then the one we did after was us in Blair Witch. And one of the biggest champions of that was Peter Block. So when we kind of were... We were dealing with another network who were... interested in the show at the time when it was called it was called Coffee and Donuts at the time. But like what Adam was saying, this network wanted to change it to us doing a podcast, and there wasn't any horror references at all. It had to be video game stuff, and it was just being compartmentalized into something that wasn't the show. It didn't have the voice of the show. So thankfully, we got out of that, and we met. We talked to Peter at it was the Reaper Awards, right? Yeah. And we were just, actually, Peter was one who was like, I'd love to do something with you guys. And I'm like, actually, we happen to have something.
I think I said I wanted to do something good with you guys because I'd already done Frozen with Adam. So, you know,
Peter Block, everybody. Peter Block. Keeping it real.
You should see his script notes.
I mean, it's interesting that you talked about the horror aspect of it and how they are together as friends, because that's really why it works so well and works so well for the network, because everybody wants to categorize you guys as filmmakers, the network, you know, maybe some of the films I've done, but, you know, the string running through them is comedy. You know, what works great in, you know, a lot of horror films is the comic relief moment. You
get. Absolutely.
Sometimes they're body and out there, and sometimes it's just a little moment to kind of, like, chuckle, and even some of the over-the-top moments give you that. What we wanted to do was kind of expand our audience and changing, you know, the concept of the show to make it kind of give it a Venn diagram that fit for our network. You know, expanded our audience base and also kind of allowed us to be able to have something that we could show to parents, that we could show to people who may not be the typical horror audience. You know, it's kind of like that whole Back to the Future, you know, thing with Chuck Berry, like, don't worry, your kids will love it. You know, that's what Holliston allows us to do with the network.
And, you know, we're talking a lot about, like, horror references and movie references. That's really not, like, that's not what the show is about. The show is about four friends who are struggling with that time of their lives. There's a love story. There's, you know, that's my big thing as a horror fan. Like, because the thing about horror, it's like we are a culture, and there's a reason for that. It's not just like romantic comedy fans or people who like action movies. Like, horror is a culture. And if anybody understands what it's like to be heartbroken, to be told no, to be disenchanted, to lose the job, to not be good enough, it's the horror crowd. And I think that's one of the things that binds us together. And that's what this show is. It's that time in your life when nothing works out like it's supposed to and you're constantly getting kicked in the nuts. But being able to find comedy in that, that's where the message that I was going for with this show, everyone's like, if there's one message in this show, what is it? And my message is it will get better.
Don't give up.
And don't give up, because it will get better. I don't know when, but it will.
Eventually.
One of the casting choices that, as you watch the first batch of episodes, it seems so outrageous, and then you see him with you guys, and it somehow works beautifully, is Dee Snider. I don't know that I ever would have thought of Dee Snider in a sitcom, and yet he's the perfect guy to kind of bounce off you. And can you talk about what he plays and sort of how you ended up with Dee in this project?
Well, the character is the character's name is Lance Rocket with two T's, and he's our boss at the cable station. And he's 54 years old, but he's the lead singer in a Van Halen tribute band called Diver Down, and he just will not give up on the fact that he's still going to make it as a rock star, even though he's 54, even though he's in a cover band. And he still comes to work in the leather pants and the fishnets and the hair and everything.
Yeah, that's not a special night out. That's how he goes to work.
Yes. and so Dee's a very close friend of mine. It was just sort of like, wow, this really makes sense. What if Dee did this? And to be honest, his first reaction was to say no, because that's what people think he is like because of Twisted Sister. And he has spent 20 years redefining himself as so much more than that. And for anybody who is a Dee Snider fan or who knows anything about him, he's nothing like that. The guy never drank, doesn't smoke. He's like a family man. He's the most normal human being ever. But because of the We're Not Going to Take It video and all that other stuff, that's what people think he is. So for him, this was a risk because he's taking a step backwards. But once he was able to realize, wait a minute, I get to make fun of this stigma and all the Lance Rockets I've met in my career. I mean, some of the shit that comes out of his mouth in this is so great, which is weird for me to say because I wrote it, but still. But he's also, when you look at a Motley Crue record or a Poison record and think that at some point chicks wanted to bang these dudes, something,
and then steal their Aquanet.
Yes, like it's funny. And so he's very androgynous on the show, and one of our pastimes at work is trying to figure out his sexual orientation, because he's never clear about it. Like, one minute he'll be talking about chicks, and then he'll turn around and tell me how nice my jeans fit. And it's just, what?
It becomes like, very It's Pat in a way, where we're just goading him on, being like, so is it that you're going out with this person named Riley? Is it a...
Is it a girl, or Riley could be a boy's name?
There's a palpable tension between you and between he and Joe that I think is going to have to be explored later in the series. It's unnerving.
I didn't get that until now.
I think right in the sex scene.
Explore that. Great.
It is, like you said, it is really a story about these people at a certain point in their life. Both you guys now are at a place where you're married, where you are making the films that you're interested in making, that you're, you know, Joe, I've seen little bits of Knights of Badassdom, and it really feels like a film where your voice is fully represented. I feel like, Adam, you've had a chance to really explore and stretch. It doesn't seem like it would be hard, though, to put yourself right back in that mindset of struggling, because I think, especially in horror, to find your voice and to be able to really navigate what is a crazy financial system at this point, it's heartbreaking often, even after you've made something.
Oh, yeah.
So how much of that, how close to the surface are you playing this? Is it easy for you to get right back into that place? And
you know, what the big picture for my character, which is, this is where it gets weird talking about myself in the third person, because my name's Adam.
Do you want me to talk for you?
That would be weird, yeah. But the one of the main like story arcs or my character is trying to get over the breakup of my childhood sweetheart. And on the page, you write this stuff that's, you know, you're going from the darkest moments of your life, the biggest heartbreaks, the worst you ever felt, and you're making these funny moments. And so you write it, and it's funny, and you do the table read, and it's funny, and you do the rehearsal, and it's funny. And then when you start rolling, and as an actor, you have to actually go there, it sucks, because it hurts so bad to have to relive what that feels like again. So there's a scene in the pilot when I first see my ex-girlfriend again for the first time, and I think she came back to Holliston to be with me, but then she introduces me to her boyfriend, who's a doctor, who's 6 feet tall, who's much better looking than me.
Kevin.
And he's just like awesome in every way. And as we're shooting that scene, I kept tearing up, and the makeup's running over and trying to fix my eyes and stuff. And so I kept wanting to go again, but everyone behind the monitors was like, no, it's funny that you're crying because it's so pathetic. I'm like, yeah, it's really fucking funny. But that's what's special about this show is you'll notice stuff like that, and you'll see like there's a ton of heart. And for a show that's got an alien in the closet and exploding heads and all these horror references, there's probably more heart in this than anything else like it. And then why don't you speak a little bit to the struggle of the career disappointments?
Because you're suited for that, Joe.
It sucks. No, it's something that was easy to fall into because, like Drew said, like, you know, when you get to a certain tier, like, before you make a movie, it's always getting to that point of, I'm going to make a feature film, that's my goal. Then you make the feature film, you know, whatever slings and barbs that you have to get through to make the movie, dealing with the creative side, then you deal with the marketing side and getting it out there. And then it's back to square one. However many people thought it was great or thought it sucked or whatever, you're now back to square one. And whether, you know, you get a three-picture deal at wherever, with the Weinsteins or Fox or with Peter Block or something like that, it's just a constant, it's a constant kick in the nuts at all times. And you have to just put your cup on and take that kick in the nuts and keep moving. So then when we did this point exactly, it was easy for us to kind of go, we know what this feels like, because it's... When you're dealing with something that is a creative-based industry like this is, but it's still business, their feelings are always going to get hurt. It's just part of the deal, you know. So for us, you know, whether it was guys who have made three features, two features, one feature or whatever, or the guys who've never made it before who just have a flip cam and a dream, it's all relatable. And I think it's for anybody. Anybody can feel that way. Everyone has felt like that way. And that was what we said from the beginning. We feel like people will relate to this because it applies to everyone. Everyone has been down there before. So man up and you'll be fine.
But let's turn it on its head a little, because, okay, you guys are established and you have your pick and your choice of options. And yet, I think we can all say that what attracted us to this was not only the desire to work together, but this is what we always wanted to do. You know, being able to, I mean, specifically this show for Adam, you know, and generally, you know, making a sitcom, you know, for me and Joe, the opportunity to be, you know, not only in front of the camera, but also, you know, creative, you know, behind the camera and making a sitcom. I mean, it's like, and then the question was, okay, there are all these limitations. We have a network that's just getting up and running. We have, you know, limited period of time that we can do it. We don't really have a budget to do it. It's like, well, why the hell wouldn't we do it? And so it's like, you know, maybe the closer you are to that place you know, it allowed you to take those risks. And I don't know that there are a lot of people who would have said, like, yeah, we'll absolutely do it. We're not going to worry about, you know, what the financial ramifications are, you know, when we strip it into syndication later. We're not going to worry about anything other than, you know, can we get craft services on the plate now, and can we get six episodes in the can so we can make six more? And it was that freedom that allowed us all to do it. I think that it had the network been more established and there was an expectation of what the shows would be, and they would be only, you know, big X-Files shows or things like that, where if you guys were, you know, making, you know, different decisions and different movies, and you had representatives telling you what to do and what not to do, none of this opportunity would have taken, we wouldn't have been able to take advantage of it. And that's the best part of the show, I think, and that's what you get on screen. You look at the show and you don't know the budget, you don't know, you know, what these guys have done before. You just know that you identify with these characters, and it looks every bit what you'd see on network television from a production value. And yet the concepts, you see, you'd say there's no other network that would put this on. And I think that's a very freeing experience for us, and I think it's going to be a very liberating experience for the viewers as well.
And that's what gave us the creative freedom, because if this was on NBC, you get one night out. And if you don't pull 8 million viewers and it doesn't fit with 2.5 minutes, is that on NBC? What is that from? CBS? Fuck it, I don't watch it. But so if you had, like, you know, you have to fit with those shows as a companion piece, and if that doesn't work, you're done. Here we have a chance to grow with a new network, and I keep likening Fearnet to MTV when it started. Like, there are no real rules there. You go into the office and it's just all these creative people that are excited and that aren't stifled and, like, forced into a box of, well, we need something to fit with Aeon Flux or whatever. Like, we could do whatever we want. Even down to the fact that these episodes aren't 22 or 25 minutes like they're supposed to be. We made them 40 minutes. When have you ever seen a sitcom that's 40 minutes?
That's not like supersized during sweeps week or something like that.
They're actually not 40. I mean, I don't want people to think that we made them 40. There's something in between 30 and 40.
It was very organic.
Sometimes they're 35, sometimes they're 40. But, like, if it was enough, it was enough, and we'd stop it. So it's like 35. This one, there was more, so it's 40. So each episode is, like, we're calling it, like, monster size. So even though there's six episodes, you're really getting 12 episodes worth of content, but it's the good content. Like, if like, jokes weren't working, we didn't leave it in there to try to get to a certain point. We'd cut it off when we wanted to cut it off. So that type of freedom was insane, and probably something I'll never get to experience again as a TV creator or showrunner.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes the show really unusual and special when you first watch it, is it doesn't, it's not formatted the same, you know, it's, sitcoms are actually, I think, 21 minutes now if you take commercials out. So it's, those, they're haikus. They have, like, one quick idea that they get to do. And you guys, it feels like these episodes breathe a bit. And I can't think of really any other directors. There was no point in the 70s where Brian De Palma was, like, turning to Paul Schrader and saying, why don't we do a sitcom?
You know, I would watch the shit out of that.
That would be amazing.
But it's a very unusual move. And I think that's one of the things that when you start watching the show, you've really never seen anything quite like it, and it doesn't really work like any other show.
But we're also prepared for the fact that we're going to take a lot of slings and arrows in doing this. This is a very bold move to do, and, like, you know, we're not so brash as to think, oh, and the whole blogger and web community is going to just embrace us and be so excited for us that we went and made a sitcom. Like, already, just when it was announced, there was this, like,
what?
Like, this wasn't supposed to happen. Adam's supposed to keep making Hatchet movies, and this isn't supposed to happen. Now, why is this happening? So we know we're in for it. But that, like, our first conversation after you'd seen it, you were one of the first people to see it, and then every single thing you said was, like, exactly what we were hoping for, because we had no idea. You could have been like, why are you doing this? Go make Hatchet movies. Like, I don't know.
Well, and that's the thing. I walked into it with no expectation, simply because I don't know what a Fearnet show looks like yet. I don't know what a sitcom for you guys looks like yet. And I think Fearnet, by not having a strictly defined identity yet, lets them really play. And I think it puts you guys in a great position to experiment and figure out what that is. And, you know, I remember the early days of Fox, when Fox had no idea what they were. And they put on Werewolf and 21 Jump Street. And you would look at their schedule and be like, they have no idea what they are yet.
Yeah.
That's great. And it is a wonderful moment to be in business with somebody, because they are still figuring it out, and you can be part of that identity when things click.
Yeah, it's like with Comedy Central and South Park, you know, Comedy Central was still, like, you know, a lot of stand-up, and I think Daily Show was, like, on with Craig Kilborn and stuff, but then when South Park hit, it was like, wait, a sitcom with paper cutouts? What the fuck is going on here? And yet, it was a huge show, and it defined, at least for programming, they went, oh, well, we can do anything we want. We can open up the floodgates in live action, animation, anything. Here, you know, between, you know, Todd and the Book of Pure Evil and Psychoville and now Halston, you don't know what to expect from Fiernet. And that, for me, that's a channel that I would want to watch and not go, well, here comes Cupcake Wars 2, you know, because it's what this channel does all at all times. Although I heard the one with Eli Roth is excellent.
Yeah, it was very good.
Well, we're gonna show a few more things in a few minutes, but I wanted to give you guys a chance if there's anything you wanted to ask the guys, talk to them directly about. We've got a few minutes, and now would be the moment.
All right. Yeah.
Yes.
So the question was, is there anything from a horror or a comedy standpoint that we're excited about considering for the show, like moving forward?
The room's
forward?
Not that big. I'm sure they heard that.
There's people way in the back.
Think about you, cheap seats. You're
this
all good.
This is
sir, did you hear the answer? Did you hear the question at all?
The answer to that is yes, and even more so than the first season, because now... Like, the hardest thing with the sitcom is the pilot, because the pilot of anything, if you guys have ever seen the pilot for Seinfeld or Friends, it's the worst one. It always is, because you got to set it up, and there's so much exposition that you have to get through. I actually love our pilot. It's one of my favorite in the series. But this season has now laid the groundwork, and everything's out there. And now we can go in so many different directions, and the fact that... all these guest stars that you saw in there, like that you saw glimpses of, these are people who did it because they're our friends, so they took a leap of faith. Now that people are seeing the show, they see what it is, and they see that it's growing, they're going to be coming to us. So we're going
to
have
them be in the show.
Oh yeah, they're going to pay us to be on the show. So
we're talking to Clooney. We're in talks.
So it can just keep going. The only challenge, though, is it's because it's a new network. Like, there's no delusions of grandeur that this thing is suddenly going to become friends overnight. Like, it's going to take a while, and it's going to take word of mouth.
As long as each one of you tells 1, 2, or 10,000 of your friends.
Okay. We'll be checking Twitter followers at the end to make sure that this was optimized.
And if you can even get Fearnet. Is there anybody here who already knows they get Fearnet on their cable lineup? Oh, good. Okay, that's great, because right. there's some places we go, like, they don't have it
everybody
yet.
Go to their house to watch it.
Yes. But then hopefully we can, like, I would love to be doing 24 episodes a season. I would love to be doing this full-time for the rest of my life, to be totally honest, and I know my film fans hate it when I say that, but I'm not going to stop making movies forever, but I've never been more creatively satisfied in my life than doing this, and I've never had more fun in my life doing this. And, you know, it's a testament when the boom operator is walking around crying on the last day of production because he doesn't want it to be over. Like, that doesn't happen often. Or even seeing grips run for something other than lunch. Like, they just, that doesn't happen. But, like, everybody had such a good time with this. So creatively, yeah, like, there's so many places I want to go story-wise, new characters I want to bring into it, and relationships I want to flesh out. And it is going to get kind of dark, too, with the direction that we're going, which I think people are going to not really expect.
Once we open up the hatch, it's going to be all over.
No, but I mean, specifically to your question, like, not a day goes by when one of them doesn't, like, text or email, like, hey, what about this? And,
yeah.
You know, so I think that however many episodes we do, you know, coming next, there's probably a multiple of that that is already in Adam and Joe's head. So.
Yes, in the back.
Excellent choice.
Awesome.
As long as it's not on a BitTorrent, I'm sure you can find it somewhere.
Thanks for asking the question that I planted with you earlier. So Fearnet is, it's actually more readily available than you think, and yet it still has a long way to go. We're in 27 million households on VOD. If you've got Comcast, you've got us in a lot of places, but you have to look for it. Time Warner, we're in the Movie Pass. Cox and Verizon were also broadly launched. The linear channel, the traditional channel that's in your guide that you want to find out, we're only in about 6 million households. We're just rolling out, as I said, Time Warner and Cox. Very limited for Comcast, which is where we're hoping we'll get a big push, and hopefully this year into satellite. The best thing you can do, though, is call your satellite cable provider, ask for it, because, you know, we've got, you know, 300 great movies. Most of them are premieres, either broadcast premieres or actual movies you haven't seen before. We've got great shows that Joe talked about, and we're really just trying to we're trying to do year-round what all the other networks are trying to do just in October. You can also find us at fearnet.com, where we have, you know, a lot of promos for Holliston. We've got some great shorts. We've got, you know, some movies going. But the real key for us as we're starting out is to get distribution. And, you know, this is at a time when everybody feels like you just need another one of something that you already have. So the great thing about Fearnet is there really isn't anything like it. I think that it's why I came to take the job, because I thought, why wouldn't you want to do this? You know that there's an audience, and yet you're constantly pitching. Distribution execs who go, yeah, I don't really get the value of it. And you're like, really? Number one at in the movies, number one on TV, number one in books, you know, and with a great culture behind it, you know, they have to be educated that the audience exists, and it's very vocal.
And before you resort to a torrent site, believe me, I know it's frustrating. Like, and we are.
Oh.
And like, there will be, it'll be on iTunes. It'll be on, like, we will get it there. And it won't take long. I mean, it'll happen very, very quick. That's all I can say right now. But yeah, what I always try to tell people is, like, I understand a little bit the philosophy of BitTorrenting something because there is no other way for you to see it and you don't want to wait. So we are very conscious of that, and we're going to make sure that this thing gets into places where you can watch it on your computer legally as fast as possible. My question for you, is that from the American Must Be Destroyed tour?
The Blood Drive.
Blood Drive?
Nice. Excellent.
13 or 14 shows.
I'm wearing my Ragnarok
17
underwear.
Shows. Dude, wait till you see episode 6. I get to go on stage. Spoiler. The best day of my life. I got fed to the maggot. It was fucking awesome, dude.
Well, that...
He's incredible. He is so massively talented. Dave Rocky plays Odorous Urungus, the monster in my closet, who's the lead singer for Gwar. I mean, Dave's been playing that character for 27 years at this point. He was the easiest yes I've ever gotten in speaking to somebody. Joe and I, and then Peter and I sat down with him separately to talk about this. And as soon as I got out, it's a sitcom and Odorous lives in my closet, he said yes. He didn't care about money.
Yes.
He didn't care about... Well, the weird thing, I wish I had a message I could play now on my voicemail, because when he calls, the line's been blurred now between who's Dave and who's Odorous, and when he calls, they sound the same. So it's, hey, Adam, it's Hunley, I don't know what this is, and then he'll just insult me or whatever. But he was so professional, so good, so fun to be around. His costume, however, smells like a bag of dicks.
It's a bag of dicks.
It's a high school wrestling room locker room.
Yes.
Yeah. He was only there for less than a week, and his essence was on set for at least 3 more weeks. I've never smelled anything so bad in my life, and I've smelled some bad shit. It's but
without a doubt, the best outtakes of the show.
Yes, actually, we have a reel of Odorous outtakes for you.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Excellent segue,
just
sir.
For you.
He's good. You got it. We can need more space up here. Robin, you were right.
We're going to have to give you another 20, yeah. Sir.
All right.
But you're my imaginary friend. You can't just leave me when I'm like this.
Get a hooker. You are such a pussy. I'd have to give you some advice that comes all the way back from my home planet of Scumdogia. Like we always say, when life throws you lemonade, gives you lemons, then you take plums and you make salad. Shove fruit up your ass, but not too big, unless you have some kind of lubrication involved, maybe grapefruit. Let him fuck your girlfriend hard. He'll do a better job of it than you ever could. You insignificant piece of maggot semen.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Man, you smell like shit. Kind of like a sewer rat feasting on the remains of a dead pregnant cat. Douchebag. Ah, fucking dork. You guys get your shit together. Seriously, get the hell out of the house.
I never saw that on Friends.
No.
Take that, Chandler.
Yeah, so obviously you're a fan. What made you make the jump from I'm a fan of this guy and the band and that show to and he lives in my closet and he's my imaginary friend who gives me advice?
Well, the idea about having an imaginary alien friend in my closet was already there. And then it was like, so what would this alien look like? Oh my God, it should be Odorous Urungus. That's who it should be. And then of course I call my agent. I'm like, you know who it should be is Odorous Urungus. They're like, the hell's that? I'm like,
what's an Odorous?
It's a suit. He's from Gwar. Like, I don't know. What's Gwar? But thankfully, Joe and I have a very good friend at Metal Blade Records who we called and explained what the idea was. And Gwar happened to be coming through House of Blues LA that weekend, and we sat down, and it was just like instant. And now he basically saw, I can't believe I've gotten all the way through this panel so far without him calling me at least like 15 times about something. He's the nicest guy ever. And just one last odorous thing. The night that we shot the scene in the season where I go into my closet and actually walk out on stage on a Gwar show, because I don't know what's in my closet, and that's how I find out. It was 2 days after Corey Smoot died. Corey Smoot was Flatus Maximus in the band, who died in November, very tragically. And the way these tours work, you can't just cancel them. You have to keep going. And so to have to be there that night backstage with a band that was so freshly mourning was awful. But they being together and being able to do this and laugh was so healing for them. But for Joe and I to be back there when everybody, like Danielle, who was Slamenster, like everybody who used to be with the band was coming back there to pay their respects, and we're just standing there like, we shouldn't be here.
It was like being the videographer at a wake.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of like, so we're just going
to shoot.
We're just going
to be here. And I kept trying to leave, and then Dave said, he's like, you know, you've been a Gwar fan for 27 years. You have every right to be here with us right now. And it was very touching.
Now get in the maggot.
Yeah, now get in the maggot. But it's something I'll never forget, and we actually did dedicate the final episode to Corey Smoot.
Can you talk a little bit about the casting of the two girls on the show? They both bring such different energy to the show. They're both so good on the show, and really talk about the casting and how you ended up with them.
I think they're the best part of the show, to be totally honest. Corey English and Laura Ortiz are so, so, so funny and so hot.
Make sure you say hot.
Yes. Laura plays Joe's girlfriend. She is this fiery little Latina girl with this high little voice. And she...
You might know her in such films as The Hills Have Eyes, as the girl with the eye on her cheek.
Yeah, she was Ruby in The Hills Have Eyes. So you don't... She wasn't very hot in that.
Says you.
Yeah. But she's an aspiring artist who paints the most morbid stuff. So she's this cute little girl, and then she'll be like, look, I painted an aborted clown fetus, or like whatever it is. And she, again, also always getting kicked in the nuts. What are the kids calling vaginas these days?
Twunts.
And then Corey English is the girl who plays my ex-girlfriend. Now, in real life, Corey's one of my best friends. I've been friends with her for years and years. So very weird for her to now be playing my ex-girlfriend. A lot of, you know, kissing, hugging, touching type stuff, which thank God it was her, because I'd never had to do that type of stuff on screen before, but at least it was a friend I could be comfortable with and not get fully aroused or, you know, make it uncomfortable. I'm going to stop me from talking, Joe. Say
seriously. Now you can all see that this was all a ruse to get into her pants.
Yes. So, but Corey's actually the singer for a country band called Broke Down Cadillac, which Joe's wearing their shirt right now. Which, if you watch the show Hellcats or anything, you would have seen Broke Down Cadillac.
My favorite
a lot.
Favorite show.
And so she's an aspiring country singer who is now a nurse. But the two of them have some of the funniest stuff in the show. To me, they're the glue that hold it together, because like there's only so much you can watch Joe and I lose all the time or whatever. But then when you get to watch two hot chicks lose with us and occasionally vomit on themselves, it just makes it much more charming.
Because Roman showers are really hot.
Well, it does beg the question, if you guys continue the series, obviously in real life it did get better. Is there a chance that this show would evolve over time? You know, that you mentioned South Park, and I've heard Matt and Trey say that one of their goals is that if you look back at the first few episodes of South Park and you look at where they end up, they want you to eventually realize it's a whole different show than it was when it began, to the point where it's almost unrecognizable. Does Holliston have that kind of flexibility for you in terms of what you could do with it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Character-wise, for sure. For sure. It's hard because you guys haven't seen the first season yet. Like, if you had their stuff, I'd love to talk about for what's going to come up. But character-wise, relationship-wise, now obviously there's the setup of I have an ex-girlfriend on the show who I want to be with, who just wants to be friends. We've seen that a million times, and there's so many places it can go. But what we have planned for that is so vastly different than what you would expect. And even though the show is based on real life, like a lot of people know that I'm married in real life and stuff, that's not necessarily how this is going to work out. Same thing with Joe and with Laura. So, and the idea that Fearnet and Peter especially have allowed us, like when we start talking about moving forward, to go darker with it. Because you normally these things, they're comfort food. They're like chicken soup or mashed potatoes, and people just want the laugh track and to laugh every few seconds or whatever. We are going to actually go to some pretty dark places eventually. But I think there's a lot of funny in darkness.
But the one thing that won't change, because I want everybody to be comfortable with it, is the budget. So we'll just...
let's discuss.
I want you to think the show's...
Let's discuss.
...going to change.
One of the things that I find really exciting about it is that is what Drew is kind of addressing in terms of having some kind of overlying arc. You know, we all love filmmakers, and we can go through and say, like, you know, I know all of Brian De Palma's films and Spielberg's films, and you kind of go like, oh, that was 1941, not so much. But here, like, we have, you know, Shin Pads is the film that we're trying to make, and it's based on the model. What?
Wait, Shin Pads, it's about, we're trying to make a movie about an undead soccer team called Shin Pads?
When they score, you die. Come on, shit writes itself. But, you know, for the whole first season, you're watching these two guys go from scripting it to shooting it, to editing it, to getting it to a famous person so maybe they'll go and tell someone about it and then they'll become big. And, you know, whether that, you know, happens or not, you'll have to find out. But that idea now can go to season two. Maybe we do Shin Pads 2. Maybe we do something else. But at least you have this under... It's not like you're watching Friends and you're going, I really loved how Ross's tenure for archaeology or whatever it was. You know what happens from season one to season six. You don't give a shit about that. You just want him to fuck Rachel. Here, you want to at least maybe see what happens to these guys and what they end up making, you know? So that, to me, I love that idea of going from start to finish on something, and when you watch all six episodes, you'll see the progress from, you know, basically the creative spark of it all the way until we're done with it. Here it is. Toby Hooper, eat your heart out.
We also get to hear from our audience, which is the other thing that's different about this. Like, so this season is done. It's going to air. So if there is a season two or whatever before we start it, we're going to get to be doing conventions and meetings and, like, all this stuff and hear what the audience thinks. And even just with my films, I'm very precious with that information. I think you can't ignore it and be like, no, I'm not going to listen to anybody. I'm just going to do what I want to do. You have to listen to your audience and feel what your audience feels, and that does help guide you sometimes when you don't know where to go.
I think that's been that is something that's different about horror filmmakers in a lot of ways, is that I do see an engagement with fandom and an engagement with the audience that is not accepted a lot of times in Hollywood. And, you know, the other thing that is different about what you guys are doing with sitcom, you're talking about the fact that there is growth and things you'd like to try and do. Sitcoms are almost about stasis. Most sitcoms are about hitting the reset button at the end of every episode so that it is exactly where it was at the start. Nothing changes and no one has any development. And it almost seems like that's the form. Mm-hmm. So to have in your mind already that you want to grow and that you would like to see these characters evolve takes it out of the realm of being the standard sitcom, I think.
But it's the gravy, though. It's like you still get that kind of stasis in a way. Like, they are self-contained episodes, beginning, middle, and end. But at least the ones who stick around for it, you at least go, oh, I see that there's a progression from point A to point Z, hopefully.
There's jokes we'll set up in, like, episode two where the punchline comes in episode four. So if you're really paying attention, like, that makes it almost extra funny where you're like, oh, my God, that's what that was. Or one of the problems that I've seen with some of my favorite TV shows is because when you create a TV show for a major network, it's all about that pilot. And yes, you do have like a treatment for where it could go when you sell that pilot. A lot of times they paint themselves into a corner, like Lost. I mean, everybody pretty much saw what happened there. Like, it was just like, all right, they're on. Oh, shit. Now what do we do? And no matter what they did, it wasn't going to be good enough for anybody, even though I feel like they did handle it very well. But with this, we already have so much planned. Like, we could go for 10 years right now if given the opportunity. If given the opportunity. Thank you.
We're going to do it like American Horror Story, which start with a whole new cast every season.
But we did already set up jokes and myths that we plan on paying off later.
Okay, so let's take a few more questions if you guys have them.
There was,
yes.
I'm just curious
Actually, not much. Laura is very photoshopped, but the rest of us, not. No, actually,
that's not true. That's totally not my fucking feet. I don't know whose feet those are, but they're not mine. Everything else, totally fine. But those feet are they're in some clip art somewhere. I don't know where they came from.
You know, two years ago, we never, at least Joe and I never would have agreed to doing something like that. But for the show, when we found out we were first doing this, it was like maybe 8 months before it was actually announced to everybody else. And so starting in April, it was like fitness boot camps and diets. And like each of us went down.
I've never eaten so much goddamn roasted seaweed in my life.
It was
although
awful.
It's fantastic. It's like you watch how fast those fucking pounds melt off. When
it's
you eat
terrible.
Seaweed all day.
But I went down 22 pounds. You went down what, like 20? 20. Four pant sizes. And then even on set, it's like the wardrobe that they designed for us, by the time you got to the next week, it wouldn't fit anymore. And so they're tying it on you with shoestrings and stuff. I mean, but we did it the right, healthy way because we started in April and we didn't shoot till September. So it was a slow period to get into shape. And a lot of it, to be completely honest, it's not because we're supposed to be real dudes on the show. It's not a show about models or whatever, but it was for our own self-confidence because it's really hard to look at yourself on camera. I mean, I'm sure you guys, even just when you see a picture of yourself, you're always like, is that what I look like? Or you hear your own voice. You're like, do I sound like that? So it's really hard. So just to have the confidence to at least not be worried about looking.
It was one less thing to worry about because everything else, I mean, especially for Adam, since he was acting and also directing as well, you know, to be able to go, at least I don't have to worry about my waddle.
Yeah.
Like that's taken care of. I mean, we have a whole episode. Can I mention this? Where we are in the toilet together.
The toilet.
No, we're in the tub together. The toilet comes later. That's season two. We are in a tub together filled with vomit, and we have the entire episode spent in this tub.
We're naked for the whole episode. So knowing that 6 months in advance, we worked to be able to do that. So thank you. I'm glad you noticed that. My wife is very happy. Traditional three camera on a soundstage. Every time we go to like the exterior to show like the apartment building, that's actually in Holliston, Massachusetts, but everything else is on a soundstage. We actually shot on the same soundstage where they shot the first four episodes of Seinfeld, and then our other soundstage, because we had two that we were leapfrogging back and forth, was where they shot Andy Griffith and I Love Lucy.
Right? Yeah.
So
and the artist.
So the was the artist there?
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, the
hit. You can see it all.
The
I think I stepped in Uggy shit one day, so I'm not surprised.
The history there was awesome. And then in terms of the live audience, normally on these things you have like the huge bandstands of people and the warm-up artists and the whole thing, and that stuff costs a lot of money, and we wanted the money on the screen. So some of the stuff, like when we're in the apartment, there is a live audience. It's not as big as what we would normally have, but it was at least enough for the actors to gauge their timing based on the jokes, so you would know how long to laugh and stuff. But what was interesting was, so then we get into post-production, the sound design, and I'm like, all right, you can hear the live audience that we had, obviously, but it's going to need to be louder at times or softer, because sometimes they laugh too much or laugh at the wrong thing. And then we were working with the same people that do sound mixing on How I Met Your Mother and Big Bang Theory. They don't even have a friggin' audience most of the time. It's all fake, the whole thing. And they're showing me, they're like, yeah, this is what comes in, and there's nothing. Or the audience doesn't laugh because it wasn't funny to them at the time. I mean, when you watch a sitcom, there's this like white noise of a laugh track. Like nobody laughs out loud that much at anything, but it's the aesthetic. So ours was actually more real than theirs in some ways, which was really cool to see. So we basically took that guideline and then we worked with it just like any other show does to make it fit. Eventually, I would love to actually have that huge live audience. Just as a performer, that is such a big rush. And it's a lot like theater where we would do 12, 13, sometimes 20 pages in a take.
Yeah.
Whereas with film, you never do that. It's like moments that you're capturing. So this was great. And 4 months of rigorous rehearsals with hitting your marks and knowing where to move.
Thank God we had the rehearsal time too, because like the four of us would just spent the summer just meeting at the Arioscope office and just eating seaweed and running lines and stuff. Because then when we got to we shot one episode, this episode two, there's a whole scene that is 15 pages long. And you know, whenever you make film, it's, you know, you're sectioning off moments, and when someone says like, yeah, I just killed this 12-page scene, you're like, bullshit. But when you do something like this where it's more live theater,
when we were finished and we had three cameras, so we're getting tons of coverage. When we finished 15 pages, like, holy shit, that went great. That went fast. Because it was all in real time. The hardest part, and like this kind of addresses what Adam was saying, was for the longest time we were rehearsing not having anybody giving us reactions, like a laugh track or just audience. So when we were on the set and then we had to kind of prepare ourselves for, wait, there's the laugh moment. And then, because if we started talking too fast, and there were a couple moments like that where when we were in the edit, we're going, there's no room for anything to augment, you know. But to be able to catch those rhythms, but it was just being on the set and having people, like, you know, the audience that we had there, it just kind of all naturally fell into place. And then 15 pages later, we were done. It was amazing.
But it was also part of the desire that we had to pay homage to what we love, which is the traditional sitcom. I mean, it was as more and more episodes and TV series are going more to the dramedy concept, we really wanted
single
to,
camera.
Wanted to get away from that. We really wanted to go throw back to what we love. And, you know, I had a great conversation with Will Barrett, who's the Adam's partner in Aeroscope and Adam's DP on everything, basically saying you spend your whole life trying to light things so that they don't look like what we're trying to light for now. You know, because we really wanted that traditional sitcom lighting. We really wanted the timing to be down. We wanted the laugh tracks. We wanted the sense that, you know, this is what you might have turned on at any point in time in the 70s or 80s. It's just nobody would have said these things.
And it's more that we weren't like, this. It's not a joke. We're not like making fun of a sitcom. It's not like Lucky Louie where you know he was playing with the convention of a sitcom and that was like his joke on it. We're embracing it so much that it's just, it becomes part of the form. Like, my wife finally saw the episodes and she was like, it was like they zapped you. Remember that John Ritter movie, Stay Tuned? Mm-hmm. And he just gets zapped into a TV show. It's kind of like that. It's like we just cut, why are you up on there? And that's a testament to how much we tried to go detail-oriented on, this is what a sitcom looks like, just with exploding heads and us, you know, so that makes it even more like fun to watch.
So, gentlemen, I think we have some things to say thank you to the people that came out and supported the panel today. Some stuff, and I'm not quite sure how we want to do this, but
we do, but we still have one more thing to show.
We do, and I think that'll be the thing that we okay. leave on.
It's the thing I'm most excited about.
Yes. But we wanted to say thank you very much for coming and supporting the panel today and for checking this out. You may not know the name Holliston yet, but I have a feeling after you've seen an episode of this, it's really hard to forget or confuse with anything else. So please take the word out and tell people about Holliston and give it a chance and find FearNet as well.
Absolutely. And if we could have afforded one more chair up here, we would have had Mark Ward, who's sitting in the back, and we wouldn't have been able to get this project going without him. He's at Image Entertainment. And you know,
stand up, really, Mark. Come on, stand up and tell everybody who you are.
It was really his belief in the project.
There he is.
Going. So.
He's going to hate me.
But we'd like to make sure that we say thank you with some T-shirts, some hats, some things that we have for Holliston.
Wear them as much as you can.
Absolutely. Yes. Everywhere you can. And then a more important thank you is this last thing we have to share, which is a gag reel from the show. And you seem giddy about this,
yes.
Adam.
Yes. All right. So the gag reel. Now, normally the last thing that you want to show people first is all your worst moments. But I think it's so funny. So we've done this like sometimes, like Joe and I did a charity event here in Austin just in like November. Yeah. Was it November? And so we brought like an 8-minute clip from an episode and we set it up. This is what the show is. This is what's going on here. This is who the characters are. After like 10 seconds, you're just, all right, whatever. Just show me the clip. Like, but with any sitcom, if someone showed you 5 minutes of Seinfeld and you had never seen the show before and you don't know the characters, it's not going to be funny to you yet. So we showed this clip, and there was some polite laughs or whatever, and then we broke at the gag reel, which at the time we were sort of told, like, don't show that. And we're like, fuck it, show it. And then the place is, like, really, like, lit up, because you don't need to know the characters yet or the show to understand how awkward it is to watch us struggle trying to act. So
it's 2 minutes of us getting kicked in the nuts by ourselves.
This is a condensed gag reel, just special for this, but this is some of our worst moments, and I think you will really enjoy this.
Enjoy!
Hey, Movie Crypt fans, Joe here from Holliston. Ah, fucking cock. Hey, watch out. Step back. You got what I need. Hey.
Drop me low.
they were sleeping, and then they first slept in shit.
They slept in shit?
Shit. Right into a noose.
Good night!
Woo!
You're gonna like the way you look!
I guarantee it.
I was a little worried it might be, I don't know, awkward running into you again.
And I thought it smelled bad on the outside.
I know what I'm going to be thinking about later. When I masturbate.
Tell me about it. No matter what I say to Joe, he's still always massively overcome. Tell me about it. Tell me about it. No matter what I say to Joe, he's still always... Tell me about it. No matter what I say to Joe, he's still always massively overcome.
Not always.
What do you think about that, Laura?
Tell about it. No matter what I say to Joe, he's still massively overcome.
Get over it.
Wait. What do I do for you?
Tell me about it. No matter what I say to Joe, he still massively overcompensates in bed.
Yeah! Encore exit metal double time! Woo! Metal!
What time does Market Basket open?
You mean Market Basket?
Market Basket.
No, the emphasis is on Market. Market Basket.
Market Basket.
No, Market. Market Basket.
Market, Market Basket.
No, no, Market Basket.
Market Basket.
No, the Market. Say Market loud.
Market. Basket.
Why are you yelling basket?
What's your name? That wasn't a fart, I swear to God. We have to start it.
Words are hard. Dick.
That Market Basket thing went on for 12 minutes. And it was amazing.
Yes.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for being here. Once again, Joe Lynch, Adam
Thank
Green,
you, everybody.
Thank
Peter
you.
Block,